Welcome to another special episode of The Filmlosophers with another overstuffed episode. These are the episodes where during this holiday season we kind of fit within the festive feast, if you will, of everyone else and engorge, as Amy has stated, we have engorged ourselves on too many movies and need an opportunity to kind of let our belt out and talk about a couple of these. So this is our opportunity to do that. I am here with, of course, my good friend and co-host of the show and Mr. He won't run a day in his life because he doesn't have to, Mr. Spencer Williams.
Nope, I wouldn't run from zombies. I just lay down and take it.
I can't go with where I was going to go.
Beautiful.
Speaking of
beautiful,
beautiful. Yes. There you go. That brings us to intern managing intern Amy.
Yes, but I would try to at least push somebody down so I could escape. I wouldn't get very far, but I'm okay with that.
Yes, the rules of zombies: you don't have to be the fastest; you just can't be the slowest.
Listen, yes. I'm asthmatic, dude. I can't. What am
so,
I going to do?
Spencer, so the funny thing is, two people
and we run.
So you what you're saying is you puff and you huff.
Yes.
Anyway, we have a great episode in store, as for this overstuffed episode, we are going to be talking about the recently dropped film that everybody has been talking about, and that is Edgar Wright's remake of the remake, if you will, of The Running Man. So stick around as we dive into that and get all to the nitty gritty, because people's got some opinions and we want to hear them. But before you do that, you can tune into all of our great brand new episodes over at our website at filmlosophers.podcast.com. There we got allegedly over 300 episodes, everything from action, anime, comedy, suspense, thrills, and chills. If you're looking for it, we got it. Head on over to our website at filmlosophers.podcast.com. You can also check us out over wherever podcasts are streaming, and it's iTunes, Libsyn, Player FM, Audio Boom, Spotify, Pandora, TuneIn, iHeart, and Amazon Music. Tune into your heart's desire on any one of those platforms. Look for us there at The Filmlosophers and give us a like or subscribe. And listen in. Tell us, did you see The Running Man? What did you think of the movie? We'd love to hear your thoughts in the towel section down below. And as always, if you like what you hear, give us a 5-star review. We've earned it.
We have.
Yes, please.
We'll give you the social links at the end of the episode. We are so excited to bring you another episode of Overstuffed, as we are ready and wonderfully waiting to kind of just get into the nitty gritty of this movie. We really love these episodes to really get a chance to dive into again those movies that we didn't get a chance to put on the schedule. And this is another one of those where we wish we had more time. And again, seeing as it is the holidays, in lieu of, you know, providing gifts and trinkets and whatnot to you for the Thanksgiving season, we're giving you more episodes. So we're giving you this overstuffed review of 2025's The Running Man. This has been a movie that a lot of us have been anticipating, and I don't for the life of me remember as to, and I'm pretty sure it was just a scheduling issue why we didn't move forward with reviewing this in our regular schedule, but life happens, things come up, and so I'm pretty sure there's a plausible reason somewhere in there.
Yeah, I didn't do it. That's the best part. I didn't do it. It was someone's fault.
And if all else fails, we can blame the intro. So,
did you just say we'll see?
I don't think so. I think Eddie was talking.
Spencer's in the right. So oh before gosh. We move any further, Spencer, why don't you give us an official synopsis? Goodness.
Working class Ben Richards enters a deadly game show to pay for his sick daughter's medicine. The show, created by ruthless producer Dan Killian, forces runners to survive 30 days while being hunted by professional assassins and broadcast to a public addicted to the violence. Ben's defiance and popularity with viewers make him a threat to the system, increasing the danger as he tries to outwit the hunters and the nation watching his every move.
Produced and directed by Edgar Wright and written by Wright and Michael Bacall, the film stars Glenn Powell, William H. Macy, Lee Pace, Michael Cera, Emilia Jones, Daniel Ezra, James Lawson, Sean Hayes, and Coleman Mingo and Josh Brolin. A couple key pieces of the film. This is actually one of four Stephen King stories adapted into movies for 2025.
Yay!
And oddly enough, one of the others is The Long Walk, which we got a chance to see not too long ago, which both it and this film were originally written under Stephen King's pseudonym, Richard Bachman. Hmm. So if not a lot of people know, Stephen King wrote under the name Richard Bachman for a time to kind of delineate from a lot of the horror elements that he was writing about and be more of a different kind of writer. So,
I mean, The Long Walk was still kind of a horror.
Yeah.
I mean, it was just, it was sad. Another key piece of information, Edgar Wright was only allowed to cast Glenn Powell as Ben Richards on the condition that Stephen King approved the choice. King signed off after he watched Powell in 2023's Hitman, which Hitman looked like a pretty fun movie. We didn't get a chance to see it, but that was a movie where he was ultimately pretending to be a hitman on dates and whatnot. And then it kind of comes across like it's a very interesting movie. And I can see why the role of Ben Richards would have been, you know, very similar to his role in Hitman. Another key piece of information, the giant N logo above the network building is colored red and resembles the Netflix logo. Everywhere else in the movie, the logo is colored white. This is a subtle dig at Netflix, who director Edgar Wright says ran trailers for his film, The World's End, in 2013, that carelessly gave away the ending. So, speaking of like holding long grudges, that's absolutely what I think it was. And to be honest, if you have all that money and the power to be able to put it into some movie about an evil corporation, why not do it? Like, it's Edgar Wright. So we are going to be talking about this film to a certain degree with a couple of spoilers. So just so you're noting, spoiler alert. This is a very interesting movie because this movie came about as a result of the popularity of the 80s film that everybody remembers, I believe it was 87.
I'm checking.
Which starred Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Yeah, it's 87.
It is at 87?
Yeah.
Cool. Mm-hmm. The fact is, the popularity of that movie was so phenomenal, and a lot of people really enjoy it for it being a cult 80s classic. Mainly for the fact that, number one, it's Arnold Schwarzenegger. Mm-hmm. Number two, it also had a couple of interesting names in it as well, such as like Jesse Ventura and so forth. As well as the gentleman who played Killian in that movie, which was subsequently a former Family Feud host, which made sense because there were a lot of people say in the funny little tidbits that I've read, a lot of people say that the way he was in this movie, the 80s movie, the show host, was very similar to the way he was behind the scenes at Family Feud.
Really?
Yeah. So there's probably a lot more dirt on there than what I've uncovered, but it's really funny for the fact that that's kind of how people saw it. But the fact remains is that that particular rendition of or adaptation of the original short or original source material was not fully accurate. So kind of going to this one was a little bit more accurate to the it touted itself to be a little bit more accurate to the original source material. So diving in, let's kind of talk about expectations. Obviously, we're talking about a Stephen King film. We're talking about an Edgar Wright film. There's a lot of different expectations we could pull from. But what I want to know most of all is where you guys drew your expectations from. Let's start with Amy.
So for me, I really actually liked the original Running Man, even though I thought it was kind of weird. Mm. I hadn't read the book, so I was actually excited when I saw the first trailer because it felt more bombastic. It didn't feel like it was poo-pooing the original, but it wanted to be its own thing. And I was excited. Also, Colman Domingo turning around in that dang trailer got me every time. And I was like, for you, yes. Yes, for you. What about you, Spence?
Yeah, no, the trailer for the movie really sold me on it because, like, it just had like, it's just a completely different vibe than the Arnold Schwarzenegger one. So it kind of seemed like it was trying to give like, hey, there's space for you to like both movies for different reasons. And I was like, okay, that's cool. I'm down for like, if you're trying to do something like completely different than the first one, I'm super willing to see what you're going to do.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I agree. I have to agree with both of you. I feel like for me, reading the story, having read the story, and then being a fan of the 80s movie for the only reason that it's like that it's a cult 80s classic. It's a classic, you know, Arnold Schwarzenegger 80s movie. you know, there's a lot of fun aspects to that movie. There's a lot of Arnold Schwarzenegger isms, you know, that he does and that he says, and it's like, okay. But at the same time, this one was going to bring a different approach. This one was going to bring in a new aspect of it. This was going to bring something that was more reminiscent of what Stephen King had written about, as opposed to what most fans would have wanted out of a story like this, i.e. the 80s film. So I have to agree with both you. Like, I was super, super stoked about this movie, not to mention the cast list of this movie. Josh Brolin playing that devious, you know, showrunner, and then Coleman Domingo as just being so bombastic in himself, just not even doing much in the film other than talking. Like, this is what, and I know we've already released the episode, so if you've heard it, then, you know, but I believe the recent lesson we did on Wicked for Good. This is what Coleman Domingo should have been doing in Wicked. If they cast him as a lion, this is what he should have been doing. Like, turn
just
around.
Talk.
Yes. 100%.
More. Let the man have more. He's fine. He can do it. Yeah. No question. Dang it.
But then at the same time, Glenn Powell, like, really rising to that occasion in this movie and really bringing something fun and energetic and chaotic. And I'm not going to lie, Michael Cera looked like he was going to be an absolute just fun fest. And I was absolutely excited to see him pump his little squirt gun. And that's not a that's not a euphemism. Like,
sounds
I just
like it.
It looked like it was going to be hilarious. So we all got a chance to see the film. And what are your guys' first impressions? Let's start with Spencer.
Okay. Man, there is so much to like about this movie. This is oddly like, okay, the trailer again did actually do a good job on like establishing, you know, this actually is different and it wasn't like a rug pull. And mm-hmm. I was happy about that. I feel like the only real thing I'll say, because we're not going to talk about the trailer again, is I wish they had taken just a few scenes out of the trailer because like, I feel like saving the Michael Cera thing would have been kind of cool with the water gun. Just like little things like that. But otherwise, I was like, I was pretty happy with this movie.
What about you, Ames?
No, I can agree with Spencer. I actually had really, really fun. I didn't think I would like Glenn Powell as much as I did in this. Mm-hmm. But then this felt so fantastic. Like, I was like, I gotta watch this again. And I wouldn't be in comparison like, oh, the 80s movie, oh, this one. I'm like, no, they're both actually really, really fun and I like this.
I have to agree with both of you. Like, I feel like Edgar Wright really took the source material and still added his unique flair to it, but still honored what was in that source material. And Glenn Powell filled the role of Ben Richards so uniquely with as much gusto as you can have, while adding, I mean, to be frank, a lot of heart to the character. And then there are elements where you're surprised and there are elements where you're like, yes. And it just felt like a really great and fresh take on the story. It didn't take away from the original 80s one, mm-hmm. which the 80s one is still iconic for its own reasons. However, this one still has a sense that makes you want to come back and see it again and again. Mm-hmm. And since we're mentioning Glenn Powell quite a bit, let's talk about the cast list. Starting with obviously Glenn Powell playing Ben Richards. I honestly feel like the only frame of reference we have for the role is Arnold Schwarzenegger. And there's not really a lot of comparison if you're looking apples to apples with, you know, another gentleman and Arnold Schwarzenegger. But the fact is, I feel like Glenn Powell made this role very much uniquely his. And his journey throughout the film didn't feel so restricted, I guess is a good way to put it. Like, it didn't feel like it had to lead to this particular heroic dynamic that we get with the first film, with the original film. There were a lot of ups and downs, and there's parts of this movie where you're not sure how or why or in what way certain elements are going to continue moving forward. And Glenn Powell just rolls with it. And I appreciate it. I appreciate his versatility to the character, you know?
Yeah, I wanted to kind of pipe in on this because Glenn Powell, it seemed like he hadn't really been in the zeitgeist for very long. And then I realized I hadn't really watched a lot of his stuff, which is on me. That's fine. I still haven't seen Top Gun Maverick. Okay, that happened. but really, like, he was He's so much fun, and he doesn't feel that he's just an action star.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't feel...
Or a rom-com star.
Or a rom-com star, or, you know, a historical figure. It really... He was one of the astronauts in Hidden Figures.
That's right. That's right. Yes, yes, yes. You are 100% right.
See? And now we're all like, oh, we recognize him now.
Yeah, because he's the one who supports Taraji P. Henson's character.
Mm-hmm. But really, when it came down to it, it's... He feels authentic, and he doesn't, his, the whole goal of trying to actually get through the Running Man mm-hmm. has an actual purpose, and it's not just because he's cray cray.
Yeah. Or he's just trying to survive. Like, there's a purpose behind it. Mm-hmm. And it really does highlight throughout each and every day that he's surviving mm-hmm. in the movie. Was there anyone else you guys wanted to bring up or highlight? Cause I want to throw it to you guys, make sure everyone has enough time.
I have two, but Spencer goes first.
Okay. So I'm going to talk about Katie O'Brien.
Yes, thank you. Thank you so much, because he did not mention her, and I die for Katie O'Brien. Oh, my Lanta. I know she wasn't on the top list, but it's okay. She was Laughlin.
Okay. Yeah. Okay.
Okay. So, like, she's not in this movie for a super amount of time, but, like, she uses every opportunity to be a standout character. Like, it's not often where the main character is doing a good job, like, where, like, you know, the main actor is doing a good job with her character. And I'm also like, okay, but what's the other person doing that the movie's not about? Like, mm-hmm. because, like, they just seem so fun, and, like, you kind of want to follow them too. Like, she brought the heat, and, like, the one action scene she did have in this movie, I thought was pretty phenomenal, with, like, just her falling off, like, a staircase and onto, like, a craps table, and then just running out of a casino. Like, I thought it was, she did phenomenal.
Yeah, I'm going to echo that, because freaking KDO, oh my lord. Everything about KDO, from not only the initial presence to finally when we get caught back up with KDO through the lens of not only the lens of some other characters who've kind of told you, like, these are the archetypes for each of the people that are on the Running Man, but when we see her tapes and you're just like, yes, I don't know what you're doing, but I love you and I'm rooting for you. Like, I really, at one point I'm like, listen, I know I'm supposed to be rooting for Glenn Powell, but I really want KDO to win. I can't help myself. Like, and she's just, she is so dang attractive. Oh yeah. My God.
And mind you, yes, she isn't on screen for a long time, but when she is, she's commanding. Like, mm-hmm. she's definitely a presence. And to be honest, it would have been great to see, you know, more of her throughout the movie, even if it wasn't in an effort to make her a focus point, like, just to give more of a glimpse of what was going on in her journey. But yeah, she is somebody that's definitely worth highlighting.
100%. Thank you so much for highlighting her. I was like, somebody needs to bring her up.
Did you have another one, Spence?
Oh, am I going twice in a row?
Well, Amy says she has two, so you might as well fit in.
KDO was one of mine, so I'm so happy Spencer did that.
Okay, well, then you go next, Amy.
Okay, I want to bring up my deep and abiding affection for one Lee Pace. I don't care how old this man is. He will always be the pie maker to me. But really, in this, he is McCone. He's basically wearing a mask for more than half of this movie. And he's just like, he's the one you don't get. It's fate and destiny. Like, his gun and his knife are named. It's so dumb. It's so fantastic. It's a lot of, you see him initially through the film, it's all all the physicality of it, which the guy is really tall to begin with. And he's not like super, super built, but I liked that he was supposed to be the overwhelming presence, but you knew he was a stooge. Like, yeah. his butt was going to get kicked anyway. But I like Lee Pace, and it was really fun, especially when we get towards the third act where we have that final confrontation and he's like just angry. Also, the practical effect on that one, like, you know, what I'm talking about with the,
you know, this is a audio podcast,
but it's for us here at the table.
Like, I don't know what you're doing, but you're just making sounds. And it's like,
that's what we're doing with our mouths while we talk as well. Good job.
See, you get upset that I do the same thing, and then you're like, oh, you're so mean to me.
You are mean to me. But really, I really did like Lee Pace. So that was my shout out for that one.
Yeah, I feel like Lee Pace is definitely a standout, especially for a role where you don't see his face for a good, three quarters of the movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The fact that he still creates that commanding presence as just his voice and his you know, physical presence itself really says a lot about what he can do with physical acting. And to be honest, he was really great. He was really unique as his role, and he really shines in that last act where he's, you know, kind of given that ultimatum towards the tail end. I'm pretty sure Amy's super hyped for the fact that he's going to be in the Practical Magic sequel.
Sequel?
Yeah, they're making another one.
It's okay. There's stories actually to tell inside of this universe, so I got you. There's books.
The confusion on Spencer's face is like...
There's books?
There was always books. There was books before the movie came out.
Listen, I was just informed of that movie's existence like 2 years ago.
Oh,
okay. And then I watched it and I'm like, this is a lot of 90s.
Exactly.
Yeah, this is very a lot much of
90s.
So.
And by the way, the books feel the same thing. So do you want some more 90s? You want us to do some flashbacks? We could do that too.
Let me know when you're done, Amy.
I'm not. I'm really happy. Okay, now I am done.
That's all you had to say about Lee Pace is that you're a fangirl of him. That's it.
It's fine.
I already talked about the commanding presence, the fact that he was like, that we didn't see him for more than, like his face, for more than 3/4 of the movie. Mm-hmm. That he literally has this commanding and overbearing presence, but also at the end you know he's going to get got because he's as much a stooge as everybody else. But he plays it really, really well. And I liked that.
I wanted to bring up someone that I didn't think I was actually going to want to highlight, but at the end of the movie I was like, what the heck, man? Like, Michael Cera... literally brought a whole nother level of Michael Cera to this movie that I'm like, where have you been? Like, what is how could somebody like Michael Cera deliver a monologue about a hot dog cart and get me all in the feels? Like, that doesn't make sense. Like, I say it out loud and it doesn't make sense, but the fact that he did and it happened still doesn't make sense.
But it's great that it doesn't make sense.
No, 100%.
He is, of movies you've seen, I think that is one of the most delightful surprises that I've seen with this overstuffed November. Mm. Like, I'm like, yes, Michael Cera, I don't know what's going on, but you're great. Let's go.
Yeah.
What's funny about that Michael Cera hot dog cart like speech is it actually made me mad for his character in that Friend. He's like, oh, don't get him started on hot dogs. I'm like, what the heck's your problem, dude?
Right?
Like, he got reverse mad at the first guy.
Yeah. I was like, why not? What? And I'm like, and the moment he mentions, like, I really, no, I shouldn't, but what's up with the hot dog cart? And I immediately was like thinking like, okay, great. Michael Cera is going to have a Michael Cera moment.
Yes.
And we're going to like get this like bombastic, like wiry kind of whole, you know, breakdown of like a child's tantrum or something. Or it was going to be some kind of diatribe against like hot dogs being like a some type of byproduct of meat or something. Like I half expected that. And we ended up getting like a really, and weird enough, as I say it, it still boggles my mind that I'm about to say it, but a really beautiful monologue that Michael Cera gives about the hot dog cart. And again, it still doesn't make sense, but the fact is that it is, and it was, and Michael Cera alone would be worth it enough to see this movie again. Like, yeah. As weird as it sounds, like I am, and this is no shade to Michael Cera as an actor. Again, his roles, what he's done, I'm sure there's an audience that absolutely adores him. He's just not my cup of tea at times. And unfortunately, that's been the majority of the most times. I did appreciate him in Sacramento, the movie, not in the city. I did appreciate him in the movie. But outside of that, I'm like, yeah, not really my thing. But
well, and the funny thing, too, is the writers, so Michael Bacall and Edgar Wright, the last time they worked with Michael Cera was on Scott Pilgrim.
Yeah.
So this is like, woo, different direction. And I'm like, yes.
Yeah.
Yes, sir.
That could actually be the reason why he was so good in this, is that like Edgar Wright actually knew how to use Michael Cera.
He's like, okay, I can't do this again. I need something. Shorter time, focus.
Well, I mean, it worked really well because you end up wanting more, like a little bit more from Michael Cera.
Yeah, without a doubt.
And his crazy mom.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, she was something else.
Standing in the hallway.
I want to see the light leave his eyes.
Yeah, she was nuts.
Absolute insanity. That entire sequence is absolutely breathtaking. Like, just... so good. Oh, my Atlanta.
By the way, speaking of Michael Bacall, the writer, he's actually the stoned guy in the scene when he ends up, like, when Glenn Powell is running through and he ends up in that apartment underneath his.
Where he's running. And he's like, you're on TV.
Dude, you're on the whatever it's called. And
Freebie.
Yeah, you go. That's you're on the Freebie.
Was a real streaming service, which is odd.
It is still a real streaming service.
I thought it closed down.
Ooh. It's on Roku.
We do have it available. Can I bring up another one of my favorites?
Sure.
Coleman Domingo.
I mean...
Freebie dissolved in September of this year.
Okay, so I wasn't terribly off.
Yeah,
I just
wasn't
paying attention and hasn't been deleted from the Roku yet.
Okay.
Coleman Domingo.
Yes.
Coleman Domingo. I want to see you in everything. I don't care. There is everything. The world is your oyster, my love. I loved how bombastic, how brilliantly, like, turned the people. The not only the stylistic nature, but everything that Coleman did just made it feel literally like it truly was dystopian. And he was not only having his cake, eating it too, but could run away at any time it was necessary. And it wasn't running away. It was walking briskly at a speed that no one was going to touch him. And I'm like, this, I love this for you. Give me more of this. If you want to take over for Stanley Tucci and be Caesar Flickerman, let's go.
Honestly, he was bringing real capital vibes. Like, he could just super pivot to, like, that universe, and he'd fit right in, and it'd be amazing.
By the way, real little bit callback. The mom of Michael Cera, just so you know, you've actually seen her before, Ames.
I hope she's not.
In fact, we just saw her. Just the other day, but you wouldn't have recognized her.
She's not in my house. If you check, woman in my house wants to see the light leap from my eyes. She's going out the window.
If you check under our cupboard, she's actually in Ready Player One.
Oh,
she is the old woman boxing.
She's the old woman that we don't really see that's just boxing that has her face entirely covered.
Yeah,
shout out to her that we wouldn't be able to tell who she was.
Yep.
But dang, homie.
But yeah, I just wanted to mention that.
Thirst for Blood. Coleman Domingo, you're amazing. Yes.
Yeah.
I think it's safe to say that Coleman Domingo is finally coming into the line of sight of Hollywood, where he's given performances and roles that he was born to do. Mm. Now, mind you, his role as the Cowardly Lion was definitely not in that same vein. But
he deserved more.
Like, again, this was a role where, again, if you were going to limit the amount of times he spoke in that particular character's role, then what was the point in having Coleman Domingo?
Yeah. You could have just done what you did with Dorothy and barely show the Caroline.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
100%. Like, I agree wholeheartedly.
Yeah, but that's not on this episode.
Nope.
That's not on this episode.
Let's get part two.
No. No,
there's no more electric boogaloos for that.
But Coleman Domingo has been absolutely killing it in a lot of different roles as of late. And I'm really glad that he's finally getting the accolades that he deserves. I mean, he had done great work in, like, 12 Years a Slave. He had done work in Lincoln.
Sing Sing, If Beale Street Could Talk, Ma Rainey's Black Bottom.
Yes, Electrical. Which was a phenomenal movie. Mm-hmm. Like, Spencer, you remember we saw Ma Rainey's Black Bottom and we reviewed it in that really short month of January.
And then I saw it and I was like, holy smokes, this is absolutely brilliant.
Yeah, Amy saw it not too long ago, actually, right?
It was about a year ago. No, it was a little longer than a year, but...
The movie came out in 2020.
Yeah.
Or was it the year after 2020?
I think it was a December, and that's probably why we can't remember it, but I feel
2020,
like
yeah.
It might have been December 2020.
Yeah. But around that same time, he also debuted in Candyman. He was in that one. I mean, he's been having roles here and there, but honestly, the fact is that he is coming to be more at the forefront for roles, for just him being him. Like, I think a lot of times, I remember the first time I saw him, what, Amy?
He wrote the book for the Broadway musical Summer, the Donna Summer musical, in 2018.
I mean.
I knew Coleman had been up for two Tonys, but I thought they were for the play, for one of the plays in one of the musicals that he did. If it's for his book for the Donna Summers musical, I might die. Like in a good way. That's just, it makes me happy. My goodness. Okay.
Either way, Colman Domingo is such a phenomenal actor, and I'm glad that he's getting more opportunities to show that range. The first time I actually saw him in anything was in the Fear the Walking Dead series, which I believe that was like 2017, 2018?
2015 to 2023.
He was in it all that time?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he was in 109 episodes.
Woo! Wow. Let's go.
Immediately it felt like the role was unique, but it wasn't right for him. Like it just, I don't know. It felt like there was just too many variables, and then they tried to shoehorn the fact that he was also gay into the movie or into the series. Hmm. And it's like, no. Up until this point, you've been feeding us a different character. Now you just want to shoehorn. Oh, and by the way, he's gay. He's got a lover that he's going to. And it's like, but everything else prior to that didn't really.
Did they mention that right when they were about to kill him off?
No, no, I don't think so.
Okay.
But it seemed convenient for the point of whatever they're trying to push. But the fact is, again, I'm excited to see him in all the new projects he's got going up. I loved everything he's done as of late.
Did you like Transformers Rise of the Beast?
I like...
No.
Because he was Unicron.
Yes.
No at all.
You're just like, except for Transformers 1.
Wait, Unicron?
He was Unicron. He was the voice of Unicron in Transformers Rise of the Beast.
Well, obviously he wasn't Unicron because, you know, that's a mighty big suit to wear. But still, I get what you're saying.
He was a voice.
Interesting. Well, either way, the fact is he is still a phenomenal actor. Also, kudos to all the other performers that were in this, William H. Macy, a ton of other folks, Josh Brolin. Josh Brolin just does, he's a super versatile actor. And the fact that he spent all that time being Thanos and then being other things at the same time, like he knows how to play the role. So this was no surprise to any of us that he did it well. But that does bring us to the story of this film. And as far as the story is concerned, honestly, if you've read the book or the novella, I don't know if it's based on a novella, short story, or a book. Do you know, Ames?
Sorry, I was just staring at the girl.
She's staring at Colman Domingo.
No,
bubble?
Well, there was the one that he ended up taking hostage at the end of the thing. She was in Doctor Who, so I was trying to figure out exactly which one. Yeah, her name is Amelia Jones, just in case, with an E, not an A. It is a novel for The Running Man.
So it's a full novel. Mm-hmm. Okay. I feel like this movie really does a great job of encapsulating to the fullest extent it could of what you experience when you read the book. Now, mind you, there's always certain parts of it missing. There's certain elements of it not there. But the fact is, the way this movie traverses feels like you're experiencing all the main hits of the book. Hmm. So if you haven't read the book, all you have to do really is see this movie first, and then you can go back and revisit it. But I have to say, like, I liked this version of this dystopic universe. I loved how it felt like it wasn't so far into the future that there's like the people who are living in cardboard boxes in sand, and then there's a wall and there's like glass buildings everywhere. Like it didn't feel like that as far as the haves and have nots. It felt tangible.
Yeah.
In fact, it almost felt so real that like it could very well be us in like 10 years.
I fully agree with that in regards to like this. It really felt like it was right around the corner, or it was, we're just right there to hop into that precipice. Like we're almost to the edge of that precipice. Because really there was almost no difference.
No.
Like, and that was scary, especially when we get farther in and everybody's in the outskirts, like more towards the rural, it didn't look different at all. Mm-mm. And then even when you got to the bigger cities, there were literally only a couple things that were different between them. And I was like, oh, so we're as close to not dystopian dystopia as we will ever be.
Yeah.
What I did actually like is them telling a story in just like things that are familiar looking, like the cars on the street. A lot of the older cars are cars you'd see now, but they just look slightly more beat up and like they've been repaired to all ends because nobody can afford a new car.
Yeah.
Which is a problem we're having now. Yay.
Right. And, well, I think this is kind of the seal of where this thought process is. So the book, which was written back in 1982, I believe, takes place in 2025.
Shut up.
No.
I'm not lying. Look it up.
I'm looking.
I believe it's 1982 is released and it takes place in 2025.
I was literally looking up cinematography and I'll go, oh, this is going to make me so mad.
which the irony of it all is.
It does take place during the year 2025 and the nation's economy is in ruins and the world violence is rising. No. Remember the problem we had with the Langoliers? No. I'm putting my foot down right now.
All right. I'm not signing up for the Running Man show that's going to be airing on NBC.
Which, I mean, oh, you take God, a look. But take a look at where we are now. Like, we literally have and it's not a lethal version, but we now have a version of Squid Games where people can win money.
Yeah. And
people are, and again, in a similar fashion, what is the network that's pushing all that out?
I really feel like they didn't even bother to watch their own TV show that they're distributing.
No, it's making money. That was the thing that they saw. It's making money and we need to merchandise and make everything make more money.
Yeah.
Like, oh my Lord. Oh my Lord. That just makes me mad now that you're like, yeah, it's 2025 and the internet confirmed it is set during 2025. So thank you, Edgar Wright. Thank you, Michael McCall. We
love yes.
you. And begrudgingly, Stephen King under your pseudonym.
Mm. Which it's funny because even though this might be a little bit more of an exaggerated situation for where we are now, it is still not too far apart from where we are now. And even in the elements of like, again, with you take a look at like healthcare, you take a look at like when it comes to medication, you take a look at things where people need jobs. People need to find steady work. And there's quite literally little to no jobs out there. And you compare that. And mind you, I'm not talking about the movie. I'm just talking about now. And then you compare that to where the movie is. And the same thing. We have diabetic medication that is getting bought out by people of the elite because it makes them lose weight. And yet it's driving the demand up for those same medications for people who struggle with diabetes, with blood with low or high blood sugar. And they are having trouble having it on hand because so many people are buying it up for the fact that it makes them lose weight without putting in the work. And it's sad. And that's where we're at now. Like you take a look at, again, there's a really great moment in the movie where Glenn Powell's character is in the car with the woman that he's supposedly holding hostage. And she's like, no, this is what, you're like. And because I saw it in the news, hashtag fake news. And he's like, oh, I saw this. And he goes, oh yeah, whatever. He goes, did you know I have a sick kid? You know, this is that. He goes, how much did that scarf cost you? I bet it cost, enough to save a life or whatever. And she's like, yeah. And then you look at nowadays, there are literally world-renowned brands who are selling tattered clothes as a means of fashion in the excess of hundreds, if not thousands of dollars. Mm-hmm. And I'm pretty sure all of us can go to our hampers or the bottom of our drawers and find shirts that look just like it. And we wouldn't get hundreds of dollars, but I'm pretty sure it would be just a dead comparison to those that are being sold now. Like we're drawing closer and closer. And I think that's one of the things I like about, I like slash am afraid of like movies like this or stories like this that really draw the comparison to what people saw us going towards then and what we're starting to create this self-fulfilling prophecy of now. You take a look at like 1984. Mm. 1984 is another one that's like, Amy was just mentioning, I know we're kind of moving towards political nature, but it's
a political movie.
It's a political movie. You know, you take a look at 1984, Orson Welles, not Orson Welles. Mm-hmm. Is it Orson Welles? Mm-hmm. 1984.
George Orwell.
George Orwell. Yes. Sorry.
Sorry. My brain was like, hold on. I was reading somebody else's name. And I was like, it's George Orwell.
But like the nature of that movie and or the nature of that story and where we are now, like not being able to say anything negative about anything lest you get arrested for it and put in prison for a long time or even put to death. And quite literally just not too long ago, there was a gentleman who posted something on social media and cops showed up at his house and arrested him and had him detained in jail for over a month and a half. Like for a meme that was against the president of our United States. And so I know that it's one of the common things that people say that, you know, people are what is it about
those who fail to learn from history are
doomed to repeat it. Yes. I raise a follow-up. Those that already know they're doomed to repeat history and still do so are dooming everyone else around them, like even without them choosing to. And the fact is, because they're in places of power, we don't have that option to be able to make those changes. We can try. Again, I hate to sound like a conspiracy theorist, but I'm pretty sure something went awry when, you know, the last presidential election came about, when it was overwhelmingly one-sided versus the other. But I'm not here to point fingers. Who knows? That's just, you know, not to sound like MatPat, but that's just a theory, a political theory. But, you know, there's a lot of elements that are just so up in the air right now that a movie like this to come about isn't just for entertainment purposes. And let's be honest, the theater, the cinema is the new library for opportunities for us to engage in stories that are so uniquely preparing us for what's to come that you can't help but feel a certain sort of way when you walk out of the theater, sometimes even empowered. Rod Serling, I don't know if you guys know this. Do you guys know the reason behind The Twilight Zone was that Rod Serling was so disgusted with the way the world around him was that he wanted to bring about an opportunity to drive awareness to racism, to discrimination, to paranoia, to all the things, warmongering, all the things around him that he tried to, he actually wrote a play and or a script for something that was, that spoke towards that. And I believe he presented it to like some of the studios, whatnot. None of them, once they realized it was political in nature, it was very point, it was very pointed to as far as speaking out about these things. When they found out it was about that, they immediately were like, no, we can't do any of this. This is not what we're about. We can't do that. And so Rod Serling brought together some of the greatest minds in science fiction and in horror and created The Twilight Zone. Because what would people gather if instead of it was white people treating black people bad, what if it was the human race treating aliens bad? Or if it was being afraid of who the monster is and having a sense of paranoia versus the people who are warmongering and having paranoia against supposed communists and whatnot in the world today. Like Rod Serling went the other way around and brought in things like people like Ray Bradbury and so forth to create stories around elements that really do tell the story and tell the truth of the world they live in. And the fact is that was done and produced and ran for almost at least a decade, if not two decades, not to mention the revival of it back in the 80s. There was a revival of The Twilight Zone in the 80s. And then Jordan Peele came back and did two seasons of it lately, all honoring the same heart of the original story. TV, the camera, the film camera has become the medium as to how we get the story out as far as the real monsters that are in the world today. And again, this movie, to kind of bring it back around, is exactly that. This is an opportunity for us to be aware that the powers that be may not always be the powers that be, And if we don't act or do something now, we will allow our history to doom not only itself, but all those that we care about in the future. Mm. Yeah. So what? I'll get off my soapbox. I'm sorry.
It's a good soapbox.
No, it's a good soapbox, and we agree with you.
Yeah.
It's also where we're very acutely aware that this film can be polarizing for people who can recognize the world around them and see that it's a one step. Edgar Wright makes it very clear that it's one step closer than we even realize.
Yeah.
So it can be exhausting for some people. It can be, you know, mind numbing, or it can be like, oh, perfect example is Michael Cera's mom.
Yeah.
You're just like, dang, Michael Cera's mom, you right there. And he's like, you can't look away.
Yeah. And it's like, to be honest, I mean, you take a look in the film, you take a look at Michael Cera's mom, and you're like, you have somebody who carries that old mentality of like hatred and anger and is so easily swayed by what's on the TV because it's what's being fed to her, that she carries this disdain for somebody she doesn't know anything about. And the way the movie portrays Michael Cera to be so flippant about it, when anyone else who would have came through, had she done that to anyone else, they would have been like, what the heck is wrong with you? Like, we as normal people look at her and we're like, what's wrong with you? No. Why do you want to see him dead? It doesn't make any sense. But because what she's fed and what she's been watching, of course, she's going to be on the side of what she's in been engaged with. And Michael Cera, who should be somebody who is a speaker of truth and someone who recognizes what that looks like, allows it to persist because she's just old. And I love the intentionality behind that, because it's like, we live in that right now where people are racist or people are discriminant, and we look at it and we don't even give it a second thought because we're like, oh, that's just the way they are. That's just the way they grew up. That was a term they used to use when she was younger or they were younger. That's just blah, blah, blah. Like, they make excuses based on the fact that they are using words and phrases that are obviously, you know, insulting and racist and discriminatory, you know, against whatever group they are speaking towards. And I found that like very unique in this particular movie, because I there's a really unique moment in that where her continuous like pushing of who she sees Glenn Powell's character as begins to kind of seep into the mindset of Michael Cera in that moment. And it may not be for the same reasons, but it leads to the same outcome. Mm-hmm. And you think of that as like the people who choose to allow those types of people to continue to act as though they go unchecked, for allowing people to speak the way they do, to act the way they do, then you ultimately become an accomplice to what they do, to what they're speaking towards. And I just, Edgar Wright is such a smart director,
100%.
And I have to give him kudos for making these points aware. Even if he's not speaking directly towards American society, I mean, even if you look in the UK, the UK is going through something very similar as well.
Feels like everyone's going through something.
It's
exactly
worldwide. And you take a look, and this story is not so unique to just our plight. It's very universal, but it's still, the fact is, if the shoe fits, you know, then it fits, you know?
Yep.
Did you guys have any other highlights or issues about them? I could go on and on, because I really loved this movie. I loved everything that this movie sought out to do. I loved how it honored the original story. And I love how, you know, I'm not going to give away the ending, but I love how it took the ending and changed it just enough to make it unique, but still adding a flair that only Edgar Wright could.
Which I think is kind of interesting too, because someone had interviewed Stephen King about this film, and Edgar Wright had sent it to Stephen King to get like the official final Chug Chug stamp. And I believe the term...
The final Chug Chug stamp, is that what you said?
Chug Chug.
You say that and you're doing a motion and no one knows what you're doing.
It's okay. Someone will figure it out. But Stephen King had said in the interview, someone had asked him about it, and he said he liked it, and it was just enough difference to keep him on his toes.
Mm.
So I was like, if that's, I'm like, that's an endorsement that he will always be like, this was how I wrote it, but this is the stuff, you know, this is the movie versus what I wrote. And he didn't see that it was a problem, or he wasn't drastically against it, which I think is a great hallmark too. Then it says a lot about not only Edgar Wright, but Michael Bacall, and how they not only decided to come at the source material, but continue to keep everybody engaged.
100%. Yeah, without a doubt. I'm trying to look. There was a unique. So Stephen King actually stated about the movie. He goes that the movie, he said, it's fantastic, diehard for our time, and a bipartisan thrill ride.
Mm.
You know, and that's from the man himself. Like, honestly, again, I don't think Stephen King's in the era of his mindset where he's so worried and focused on his works being adapted and being changed so enormously. I think he's just focused on his works being adapted and the heart of it still getting across, which, you know, obviously we've had our fair share of talking about Stephen King. So then there's been several moments where he's not been very happy, but either way,
just a few.
But either way, the fact is, like, you know, this movie carries the heart of what exactly that original story wanted to, you know, that original story wanted to convey. And you can't really look at it and not be moved by what it's setting out to tell you. And of course, the design of it, the world design, the way it you know, stores a lot of the energy in certain aspects to only explode, as Glenn Powell only does on screen. I feel like there are really unique moments where Glenn Powell just kind of keeps his energy in, and then at that right moment just becomes the fireball of energy that he needs to become for the scene, especially when he's matching it with other people. So, were there any other highlights or issues you guys had?
Spencer?
you know, not really, which I feel like speaks pretty good. Stephen King has had a pretty good year for adaptations, to be perfectly honest. But for me, no, I feel like this movie's mostly pretty solid.
Yeah. All right. Well.
Hi. Hey, I want to do a highlight.
Okay, sorry. I thought you had mentioned one. My bad.
So cinematographer. I've been trying to say that word and I can't get it out.
It's hard sometimes.
He's Chung Chung Hoon.
Mm-hmm.
Why
does that name sound familiar?
Because he's been in so many amazing things. And that was the reason I wanted to bring him up. He has literally done Me, Earl and the Dying Girl. So he's been the cinematographer for Old Boy.
Yes.
Me and Earl and the Dying Girl, The Handmaiden, It.
The new It
with Ayumu Shetty. Yeah,
that's
Hotel
why.
Artemis, Zombieland, Double Tap, Last Night in Soho, Wonka with Paul King, Heretic, and then Running Man. And also he was the cinematographer for the Obi-Wan Kenobi series with Deborah Chow.
Mind you, he was the cinematographer for the original Old Boy, not the remake. So, he was also the cinematographer for The Handmaiden.
Mm-hmm. He likes working with Park Chan-wook.
Yeah.
But I just wanted...
And Edgar Wright.
Yes.
Because Edgar Wright also did Last Night in Soho.
Yeah, which I wanted to... So the reason I wanted to bring him up is because stylistically, the cinematography for this is another one that drives really, really well. You don't feel like anything's really lagging when it comes to the movement, but also things are framed in such a way that it's compelling. And I just want to give the man shout outs because... I can honestly say that without his cinematography, I don't know if I would have, like, I'm engaged in the story, but it was fun. And it felt like at moments like you were on the edge of your seat or you were participating. And it also gave space for me to be an observer, but be a participant simultaneously. And I liked that.
Mm-hmm.
And it was something that's really, and looking at his cinematography, his line of work, I'm like, oh, that makes sense. I like you.
Well, I mean, you look at the man who redefined what the one take looks like. in movies when you look at that original scene from Old Boy,
the long hallway shot,
but not from the from one end to the other look perspective, but from the side view of the entire hallway, and just the dynamic fluidity of that and raw, you know, the raw nature of that scene in how the characters, you know, act and fight, vulnerability. That's what I was looking for. The raw vulnerability that they show in that scene. It's a very unique scene, and it's a very unique choice to take it that way. In fact, it was so unique that we saw it being repeated and homaged everywhere. In fact, Daredevil did it twice. Mm-hmm. The movie, I mean the show, not the movie. But it's such a versatile choice in cinematography that he redefined the whole way people look at fight scenes. Mm-hmm. He redefined the way you look at heartbreak and anguish without being so overtly expressive. He has been able to see the way people emote emotion without whispering a word. Mm-hmm. And I love that about this particular cinematographer. So that's really great that he was a cinematographer for this one, because again, you have somebody who is so expressive like Glenn Powell, who almost made me cry just about every time he was trying not to cry. And it's like, oh my God, you know, because there was meaningfulness behind it and the scene carried that weight. Mm-hmm. So yeah, that's cool. I'm glad you found that out.
Yeah.
I wanted to say it earlier, but there was soap and boxes involved. And I just wanted to be like, I wanted to make sure that at least the highlight.
I'm going to go to the editing room and just remove all of that. And it's just going to go straight from that.
I mean is I really wanted to, in relation to not only talking about the cast, but talking about the story, I was able to give the proper shout out to the cinematographer because that does drive the story. It helps to drive the story. But we never got there. And that's okay.
No, I'm glad you brought that up because I completely forgot how impressive, especially the certain shot when he's in that hostel hotel thing. Mm-hmm. That was actually really fantastic.
Yeah. It was super cool. And it was pretty much all done by drone practically.
Yeah.
So,
which worked out well that they used drones in the movie.
Inside, outside. Yes. It made so much more sense. And then we keep talking about that hot dog cart and that entire sequence in the house with Michael Cera and his mom.
Yes.
That entire thing was so much fun. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't feel like you're chasing anyone down. It feels like you're literally a participant in it. And so that's 100%.
Like you're a part of the group that's running away from everything that's happening.
It also feels like you're watching adults like Kevin McAllister having fun.
Yes. 100%.
That's a happy holidays for everybody, baby.
So wrapping this thing up, let's go ahead and go around the table and talk about whether the film passes or fails and how many monocles. Let's start with Spencer.
Ooh, okay. This movie passes for me. Yeah, this movie has actually a really fantastic message just throughout of the dangers of the paths we're on and maybe we shouldn't be on it. But also, it's filling a world that is just terrible and I would never want to live in or visit. So it's really a movie that has a lot to say and is just also, like I said earlier, standalone from the other one and doesn't really interact with it in any way. Besides, two characters having the same name for the most part, mm-hmm. they're two separate things. So, if you like that first one, check this one out. You might like this one, too. I think I'll give it a 4 out of 5. It's really good.
Yeah. Amy.
So this one passes for me, too. I really actually enjoyed this ride, like Spencer stated, and I stated at the top. It is its own thing, but simultaneously, it's kind of living in that world as well. There's little homages and little nods here and there to the 1980s version that you do get to see, which I appreciated because it was, mm-hmm. i.e. the dancers in the opening of the number. I was like, yes, very nice choice. Great, great cast, great performances, great writing, great directing. This is a fun one that I feel a lot of people, because they're like, oh, it's just the 1987 one, it's a rehash, they're going to ignore it. And you really shouldn't, because sometimes the more fun you have, you actually learn something along the way. So I'm actually giving this a 4 out of 5 as well.
Hmm. Yeah, there you go. I agree. This movie definitely passes for me. It definitely brings the story to the forefront in a much deeper and richer way and a deeper experience that we have with the character that we've all known and loved from the Arnold Schwarzenegger film. I do feel like this adds more gravitas to the reasoning for Ben Richards and not just an inmate or a prisoner who gets put into a game for the sake of it. I definitely appreciated all the elements of the movie. I definitely wanted to continue with this story, but knowing that all great movies have to come to an end, I do appreciate how this film also wrapped up. And I loved the way Edgar Wright adds his own flair to his movies, especially in this one. And so with this one as well, I do have to give it a 4.5 out of 5. This movie is absolutely a thrill ride. It's one that you cannot miss. And I definitely would say it's worth, you know, you checking out and having the time of your life with your family this holiday season. So, but yeah, that about wraps up another awesome overstuffed episode of The Filmlosophers. We thank you for joining us this wonderful holiday season, and we're so glad that you were able to make us a part of your holiday time. Again, if you want to check out all of our other great content, you can head over to our website at filmlosopherspodcast.com. There we got allegedly over 300 episodes, everything from action, anime, comedy, suspense, thrills and chills, holiday movies and the such. If you're looking for it, we got it. Head on over to our website at filmlosopherspodcast.com. You can also check us out over wherever our socials are, over at facebook.com/filmlosophers and on Twitter, Instagram and Threads at filmlosophy101. And at Blue Sky at filmlosopherspodcast.social. Over at our Instagram page, you can catch all of our extra content, such as Spencer's Big Score and Amy's Jane on Scene, which can be found where?
The only place it's ever lived, which is at Jane on Scene on Instagram and Instagram only. And I'm really excited to do some more streaming as for Love You Lovers, you guys, because it's not Christmas movies, Spencer. It's not so she says. Christmas movies. But if we want to do Season of Suffering, I'm always available for that, too.
Hey. We're gonna take a left turn. Because if we're going to do Season of Suffering, we're just going to do a bunch more real shorts. So, no. And speaking of suffering, you can also check us out over wherever podcasts are streaming, and that's iTunes, Libsyn, Blair FM, Audio Boom, Spotify, Pandora, TuneIn, iHeart, and Amazon Music. Tune into your heart's desire on any one of those platforms. Look for us there at The Film Losspers, and give us a like or a subscribe. What did you think of The Running Man? 2025 is The Running Man, to be exact. Did you like it? Did you prefer the 80s version better than this one? Let us know your thoughts in the towel section. We actually really love reading those, and we get a great kick out of seeing everybody who responds. Also, if you like what you hear, give us a 5-star review. We've earned it.
Yeah. Yes.
I have the hiccups. I'm not on a delay. I just got hiccups.
That was amazing.
Thank you again for allowing us to be a part of your holiday season. And if you have a chance to, you know, celebrate with friends and whatnot, and you want to share this episode, share it with your friends. And we'd love to know their thoughts as well. But of course, from all of us here at The Filmlosophers, I'm Eddie.
I'm Spence.
I'm managing intern manager Amy.
Happy holidays and class dismissed.